Chapter 5. This went on for some time. A year later, when I ran into Nicholas, he was still seeing written pages in his sleep, although not as frequently. One interesting thing he told me was that he had discovered, upon falling into and out of sleep, that the writing appeared in his dreams only between 3 and 4 a.m. "That must mean something," I said. The only words he had been able to read clearly had to do with him, although he was certain that his name appeared frequently in other texts. This passage ran, "A record clerk in Berkeley will have many troubles, and at last he will..." No more. The rest had been forgotten or just plain blurred. In that dream the book was held by, of all people, me. I stood with the pages open and extended to him, inviting him to examine them, which he did. "Are you sure it's not God talking to you?" I said. That was an unpopular topic in Berkeley, when it was a topic at all. I said it just to needle him. But he himself had said that the great open pages, the large old-looking books, resembled Bibles he had seen. He had made the connection himself. However, he preferred his theory that an extraterrestrial intelligence from another star system was conversing with him, and for this reason he kept me posted about his experiences. Had he decided it was God, he undoubtedly would have ceased talking to me and consulted a minister or a priest, so his theory was a lucky break for me. Lucky, that is, insofar as I was interested in what he had to say. However, since he had seen me in his dream extending the written page, I was involved somehow. But although I was a professional science fiction writer, I could not really give credence to the idea that an extraterrestrial intelligence on another star system was communicating with him. I never took such notions seriously, perhaps because I was a writer of such things, and was accustomed to dredging them up from my own mind in purely fictional form. That such things could genuinely occur was foreign to my way of thinking. I did not even believe in flying saucers. It was a hoax and fiction to me, so perhaps of all people he knew to confide in, Nicholas had picked the worst. As far as I was concerned, it was a chronic fantasy life that Nicholas's mind had hit on to flesh out the little world in which he lived. Communicating with Valis, as he called it, made life bearable for him, which it otherwise would not be. Nicholas, I decided, had begun to part company with reality, out of necessity. Being a record clerk in a city of educated intellectuals was too much for him to endure. This was a classic example of how the human mind, lacking real solutions, managed its miseries. I stuck to this theory about Valis for several years, up to the day in the late 60s, when I personally saw Valis heal Nicholas and Rachel's little son of a birth defect. But that came later. There was a lot, it turned out, that Nicholas hadn't told me from the start. He tailored what he said. It was his intention not to appear crazy, which is a desire indicating some residual smarts, some vestigial grip on reality after most of it had fled. He knew he shouldn't be experiencing what he was experiencing, and he knew that if indeed he was, which he was, he should not talk about it. He selected me to tell because I wrote science fiction, and therefore, he presumed, I was more tolerant, more broad-minded in regard to contacts with non-humans. That was one matter Nicholas was certain about. Valis was non-human. Regarding all this, Rachel, his wife, took the cruelest and most derisive attitude imaginable. Her Berkeley intellectual ferocity grew continually. Nicholas, if he tried to discuss Valis in front of her, was immediately subjected to sneers that beggared description. You would have thought that he had become a Jehovah's Witness, another area of boundless contempt on his overeducated wife's part. A Jehovah's Witness, or a member of the Young Republicans, some abomination of such an absolute nature as that, something that set him apart from reasonable man entirely, which I guess the narrations about his experiences with Valis did. You could hardly blame her. Except, I always thought, the excessive harshness was unnecessary. She should simply have sent him over to California State Mental Hygiene for some group therapy. I still thought Nicholas should move to Southern California, mainly to get him out of Berkeley. He did go, but just to visit Disneyland. Still, that was a trip of sorts. It meant he had to get his car fixed up with new tires. He and Rachel piled their sleeping bags, tent, and Coleman stove into the back of their Plymouth and set out, with the intention of sleeping on the beaches in order to save money. Nicholas also had a secret mission, about which he did not tell his boss, Herb Jackman. According to Nicholas's official story, this was simply a vacation. In actuality, he confided to me, his best friend, he would be visiting Progressive Records in Burbank, where he knew someone, their West Coast representative, Carl Dondero. This little record outfit put out folk music records, which sold better in Berkeley than anywhere else. And since Nicholas was part of the Berkeley scene, he spent a lot of time listening to such folk singers as Josh White and Richard Dyer Bennett, owned as many Hudson Back Bay ballad records as existed, and could tell you who revived the five-string banjo. Pete Seeger, Nicholas claimed, and then discoursed on the Almanac Singers, with whom Seeger had sung anonymously. The idea was that Nicholas, if he liked what he saw at Progressive Records and liked what he heard from the brass there, might go to work for them. I had met Carl Dondero once, and he and I both felt that Nicholas should get out of Berkeley. This was Dondero's way of accomplishing it. What Carl Dondero had not thought out clearly is the ominous fact that Los Angeles is the nut capital of the world, that every religious, paranormal, and occult group originates there and draws its followers there, that Nicholas, were he to resettle in the Southland, would be exposed to other people like himself, and hence would probably worsen rather than mend. Nicholas would be moving to an area which ill-defined the quality of sanity. What could we expect from Nicholas if he were exposed to L.A.? Vallis, most likely, would emerge into the open as Nicholas's meager contact with reality dwindled out of existence entirely. Nicholas, however, did not in fact plan to move from Berkeley. He and it were too closely bonded. What he looked forward to was lunch with the brass from artists and repertoire at Progressive Records. They would woo him and wine him, and he could then triumphantly say no to them and return to Berkeley, having been given a viable alternative which he had turned down flat. For the rest of his life, as a record clerk on Telegraph Avenue, he could tell himself that he had chosen his life in preference to the disloyalty of moving to L.A. But when he got down to the L.A. area, in particular down to Orange County and Disneyland, and had had a chance to cruise around in his old Plymouth, he discovered something unexpected, although more or less in fun I had suggested it to him. Parts of that region resembled his Mexico dream. I had been right. Upon leaving the freeway near Anaheim, he took the wrong exit ramp and wound up in the town of Placentia. He discovered Mexican buildings, low-rider Mexican cars, Mexican cafes, and little wooden houses filled with Mexicans. He had stumbled onto a barrio for the first time in his life. The barrio looked like Mexico, except that there were yellow cabs. Nicholas had made actual contact with the world of his visionary dream, and this changed everything in regard to taking the job at Progressive Records. He and Rachel returned to Berkeley, but not to stay. Now that he knew an actual world existed as depicted in his dream, as seen in his dream, Nicholas could not be stopped. "I was right," he told me on returning to the Bay Area. "It wasn't a dream. Vallis was showing me where I ought to be living. I have a destiny down there, Phil, that dwarfs anything you can imagine. It leads to the stars."
"Did Vallis tell you what your destiny down there is?" I asked him.
"No," he shook his head. "I'll find that out when the time comes. It's the same principle as in the spy services. You're to know only what's necessary for you to know. If you understood the big picture, it'd blow your head off. You'd go crazy."
"Nicholas," I said, "you'd quit your job and move down to Orange County because of a dream?"
"As soon as I saw the barrio in Placentia, I recognized it," Nicholas said. "Every building and street, every car that passed, they were precisely as I dreamed them. The people walking along, the street signs even, down to the smallest detail. Vallis intends for me to move down there."
"Ask him why before you do it. You have a right to know what you're getting into."
"I trust Vallis."
"Suppose he's evil."
"Evil?" Nicholas stared at me. "He's the absolute force of good in the universe."
"I'm not sure I'd trust him," I said, "if it were me in my life. I mean, you are talking about your life, Nick. Here you are giving up your house and your job and your friends because of a dream he shows you, a preview. Maybe it's just precognition on your part. Maybe you're a precog."
I had written several stories about precogs, in fact a novel, The World Jones Made, and I tended to view precognition as a mixed blessing. In my stories, and especially in the novel, it placed the character in a closed loop, a victim of his own determinism. He was compelled, just as Nicholas seemed now, to enact later what he foresaw earlier, as if by previewing it he was destined to fall victim to it, rather than obtaining the capacity to escape it. Precognition did not lead to freedom, but rather to a macabre fatalism, just as Nicholas now displayed. He had to move to Orange County because, a year ago, he had experienced a preview vision of it. Logically, it made no sense. Couldn't he avoid going just precisely because he had suffered a premonition?
I was willing to admit that what Nicholas saw in his dream vision was an accurate representation of the barrio down in the city of Placentia in Orange County, but I saw it more as a paranormal talent on Nicholas's part than a communication from an extraterrestrial entity in another solar system. One had to draw the line of common sense somewhere. Using Occam's principle of scientific parsimony, the simplest theory was mine. One did not need to drag in another, more powerful mind. However, Nicholas did not view it that way. It's not a question of which theory is more economical. It's a question of what's true. I'm not in communication with myself. I have no way of knowing that my destiny lies down in Placentia. Only a greater mind, above human level, would know that.
Maybe your destiny lies directly at the center of Disneyland. You could sleep under the Matterhorn ride and live on Coke and hot dogs like they sell there. They're bathrooms. You'd have all you need.
Rachel, who was listening to all this, shot me a look of pure malice.
"Well, I'm just doing what you do," I said to her, making fun of him. "You don't want to live in the L.A. area, do you, Rachel? Outside of Berkeley?"
"I'd never live in Orange County,"
Rachel said vehemently.
"There you are," I said to Nicholas.
Nicholas said, "We're thinking of splitting up, so she can continue on at the university and I can pursue my destiny down there."
That made it real. Divorce based on a dream. What strange grounds. Cause of divorce? I left my wife because I dreamed about a foreign land, which proved to be 10 miles from Disneyland, near a lot of orange trees, down in Plastic Town, USA. It was unreal, and yet Nicholas meant it. And they had been married for years. The resolution to this came 3 years later when Rachel discovered that she was pregnant. Those were the days of the diaphragm, which wasn't all that good. This ended her university career. After she had little Johnny, she didn't care where they lived. She got fat and sloppy. Her hair became a mess. She forgot all she had learned at school and instead watched daytime TV. In the mid-60s, they moved to Orange County. In a few years, Ferris F. Fremont would become President of the United States.